from the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. At first glance, the small West African nation of Equatorial Guinea is doing well. Sandwiched between Cameroon and Gabon on the Gulf of Guinea, the oil-rich nation of 820,000 has a per capita GDP equivalent to that of the Czech Republic or Portugal. But the picture is more complicated than that. Much of its population lives in conditions similar to that in the world's poorest countries. Infant mortality rates are worse than in Ethiopia or war-ravaged South Sudan. Many people lack access to clean drinking water, and about half the population lives in poverty. A large chunk of Equatorial Guinea's oil revenues are thought to have been lost to corruption. All this has taken place under the watch of President Teodoro Obiang, who's been in charge since 1979, when he ousted his own uncle in a military coup. From the capital Malabo, Obiang has ruled with an iron fist as his son, the country's second vice president, has made headlines around the world for lavish spending on a fleet of Ferraris and Bentleys, mansions in Malibu and Paris, and for acquiring perhaps the world's greatest collection of Michael Jackson memorabilia. When it comes to media, Equatorial Guinea ranks near the bottom of Reporters Without Borders' World Press Freedom Index, grouped in with countries like China, Somalia, and Iran. All broadcast media in the country is controlled by the government, and there is virtually no private press. Despite these accusations, Obiang has had little opposition within the country during his 36 years as president. He was even quoted once as saying, "What right does the opposition have to criticize the actions of a government?" On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at the future of this small nation and the challenges it faces as its oil revenues begin to dry up. Joining us this week from Washington, D.C., Tutu Alicante, Executive Director of Equatorial Guinea Justice, a human rights group. From Berkeley, California, Tawanda Kanema. He's the producer of the 2014 documentary The Prince of Malabo, Power, Money, and Impunity, which examines corruption in the country. He's also a producer for Al Jazeera's digital news platform, AJ Plus. And from London, Oscar Scafidi, a travel writer who's the author of the upcoming Brat Guide to Equatorial Guinea and a business risk consultant on Africa. Tutu Alicante, you yourself are an exile from Equatorial Guinea. Give us just a brief history of how President Obiang came to power and the trajectory of his rule in Equatorial Guinea.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me in this program. I think the American people have to know more about Equatorial Guinea, a country that up until 1968 was under the arms, I guess, under the control of Spain as a Spanish colony. But we gained independence in 68, and from 68 to 79, we had one of the worst regimes, and that was the regime of Francisco Macias, uncle of President Obiang. Obiang has taken over since, and some minor progress has happened. But overall, the situation of poverty, the conditions that affect most of the people in that country have not changed significantly.
And what about, I understand there was the oil discovery in the mid-1990s. How did that change Equatorial Guinea?
Equatorial Guinea in the mid-1990s went from being an isolated, poor, repressive nation to still a repressive, isolated, but now no longer poor, filthy rich. You know, as you mentioned in your introduction, we have a GDP per capita. I mean, we have the highest GDP per capita in Africa, right? Thanks to the oil discovery, oil and gas, right? But when you look at the Human Development Index, we still right at the bottom, right there with South Sudan, with Haiti, with the DRC Congo.
Oscar Scafidi, you're a travel journalist. You've lived in West Africa, different parts of Africa. What is striking to the foreign traveler about Equatorial Guinea? Do you see the effects of this oil boom as you travel around there?
Yeah, I think it's very hard not to. I think it's quite incredible traveling around Malabo and also just to the northeast in Sopopo, the business district. You see the level of investment that has gone into the new infrastructure projects. And traveling around the mainland as well. I mean, everywhere you go, you see large, brand new roads and a lot of sort of urbanization projects. One of the flagships being the brand new capital city of Ayala in the center of Rio Muni.
And Tawanda Kanema, you made a documentary about the president's son, Teodoro Nguema Obiang. He's now the second vice president of the country. He used to be the Minister of Agriculture. Why were you so interested in him? How did you get interested in the story of Equatorial Guinea?
Well, the story begins, for me, the story begins in 2004 when a group of mercenaries was arrested at the airport in Zimbabwe, in Harare, on their way to overthrow the government of President Obiang. So once I got to California and discovered that there was a case in the U.S. District Court in Los Angeles alleging that Mr. Obiang had laundered at least $72 million into the United States through 29 bank accounts held in California, I became interested in retracing that story and really finding out what was going on. I wanted to get Mr. Obiang's side of the story, and that's what led me to Malabo, and that's what led me to make this documentary.
And Tutu Alicante, on the operational level, give us a sense within Equatorial. We just heard Tawanda Kanema talking about 70-some million dollars potentially being laundered into the U.S. Who actually controls the oil revenues within the country? You know, I've seen it reported there are about $2 or $3 billion coming to the country each year just from oil. How much of that money is actually spent on the country's infrastructure? Oscar Scafidi was just saying there's some really spectacular projects, infrastructure projects happening in the country. How much of it is disappearing elsewhere? Do we have a good sense of that?
Well, Equatorial Guinea really is ran as a mafia, right? As a mafia where one family controls absolutely everything. President Obiang has been quoted as saying, you know, the resources of the country or the revenues of this of the oil in this country are a state secret, right? A state secret that only he and members of his family know about. As you mentioned, one of his sons, the one involved in the cases that Tawanda has documented wonderfully, was a minister of agriculture and right now holds a position that does not board with the constitution, the second vice president, right? The other son, who is a minister of mine, controls basically everything that has to do with the mining industry. And then, and just like that, you know, he has either his sons or his cousins or nephews in all key positions, Ministry of Economy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's next to impossible for a lay person like myself to tell you how much money is disappearing in that country, right? We know how much the U.S. Senate has documented that appear in the Riggs Bank. We know how much money is now involved in a case.
Riggs Bank was a bank in Washington, D.C. that collapsed after it was accused of money laundering for the Equatorial Guinean government. Is that right?
Exactly. We have an ongoing case in Spain where recently the Kokorev, a Russian couple, they were acting as middleman for President Obiang's family, has been arrested. And we know how much money is involved in those cases. But what we don't know, the unknown unknown here, you know, is how much money is disappearing elsewhere. You know, how much money is Gabriel and his many companies laundering through banks and companies in London, in South Africa, and in many other places. You know, so the unknown unknown here is more terrifying than what we naturally know.
Oscar Scafidi, you traveled to Equatorial Guinea, did extensive research there when writing the travel guide. Do ordinary Equatorial Guineans, do they have a sense of some of the corruption allegations against their leaders? And sort of what's their take on that?
Well, I think, as you commented on earlier on, there's very restricted access to the sort of free media in the country. So not the sort of access that we have here. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, people are able to access social media. They are able to see these accusations. And it's not really a topic of conversation, an open topic of conversation with outsiders. But it's certainly something that everyone's aware of, I think.
And many countries with really high levels of inequality around the world, you see high levels of crime, violence, civil conflict. Is that something that you see in Equatorial Guinea?
It's not something that I saw in Equatorial Guinea in terms of the crime. In fact, I found a lot of the places that I went to be some of the safest in that part of Africa. So no, I don't think there's a serious crime problem in the traditional sense somewhere like Malabo or Bata. I don't know if the other guests would agree with that.
So I actually agree, you know, that Equatorial Guinea is a relatively safe place, right? The violence that you see in many other places in Africa, you do not see there. However, internet penetrability in Equatorial Guinea is very low, about 4%. And Facebook is blocked in Equatorial Guinea. There is no Twitter in Equatorial Guinea. Several websites several websites, including websites of the opposition political parties inside the country, have been blocked by the government, right? So do many people know about corruption and the level, the extent of corruption that exists in Equatorial Guinea? The answer is actually no.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the tiny nation of Equatorial Guinea and how corruption and media crackdowns have been the norm for the past four decades. Our guest this week from Washington, D.C., Tutu Alicante, Executive Director for Equatorial Guinea Justice, a human rights group. From Berkeley, California, Tawanda Kanema, producer of the documentary The Prince of Malabo, Power, Money, and Impunity, which looks at corruption in Equatorial Guinea. And from London, Oscar Scafidi, author of the new Brat Guide to Equatorial Guinea, a travel journalist who specializes in writing about difficult places to visit. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read in-depth articles on international affairs and free press issues, and download past episodes from our archive. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Tawanda Kanema, you had mentioned briefly that the U.S. Department of Justice had been bringing a case against Equatorial Guinea. That case has been settled. President Obiang's government has also faced some legal prosecution in France and elsewhere in Europe. Give us just an overview as to where the state of play is with those corruption investigations by foreign authorities and what's likely to happen next.
Right now, we know that, you know, there were assets acquired across at least five countries. So we were looking at the United States, we're looking at France, we're looking at Spain, we're looking at Brazil and South Africa. And At least one case in those five countries is still active, the case that was brought by the French government over a $120 million mansion that Mr. Obiang bought in Paris.
And, this is the younger Obiang, the vice president.
Yes, this is the younger Obiang. So the French government officially indicted Mr. Obiang over the purchase of the $120 million mansion that is in Paris. And the 11 sports cars that were seized from his properties in Paris and millions of dollars worth of assets also in Paris. So that case is still open. And the U.S. case, meanwhile, they have come into a settlement where Mr. Obiang was asked to pay $16 million, which is supposed to go towards a charity that benefits the citizens of Equatorial Guinea. And we also had documented the purchase of the $38 million private jet, but that asset was removed from the United States, and so they were not able to pursue it. So we're still looking at cases that have been brought in Brazil, where Mr. Obiang also acquired a mansion, and nothing has been brought on the case in South Africa, where there are two other properties there. So right now we're still looking at the property in France for which there's an ongoing case.
Well, let me ask you about Equatorial Guinea's relations with the United States, with other Western countries, Tawanda. And I want to read a quote to you that came from the settlement agreement with the U.S. Justice Department. And this is from Assistant Attorney General Leslie Caldwell. Through relentless embezzlement and extortion, Vice President Nguema Obiang shamelessly looted his government and shook down businesses in his country to support his lavish lifestyle, while many of his fellow citizens lived in extreme poverty. After raking in millions in bribes and kickbacks, Nguema Obiang embarked on a corruption-fueled spending spree in the United States. And so I guess my question is, if this is such a bad government, how is it that the president, Nguema Obiang's father, comes to be photographed at the White House repeatedly with President Obama, with the First Lady?
Well, this is the paradox of international politics, where you have the relationship of a government to its citizens is different from the relationship of a government to other governments and, you know, its position in the international community. So you see gross human rights abuses and pilfering, looting of the national treasury at home, and you see sort of this acceptance and couching. And in international politics, I think there is more done to protect and reward the perpetrators of financial crimes than is done to actually protect the victims. you find that Mr. Obiang, being vice president, now enjoys diplomatic immunity and can claim diplomatic immunity as a head of state. So the relationship of the Equatorial Guinea to the United States, I think, is more predicated on its position as the third largest producer of oil in sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, there's really strong lobbying in D.C. by oil companies and their representatives to sort of whitewash this government's image and put it in good books with Washington and other global capitals. And you have, on the other hand, you...
Oscar Scafidi, I'm sorry that we lost Tawanda there on the audio briefly. You were in Equatorial Guinea recently. Give us just a sense of what role foreigners and foreign investment plays in the economy. I understand that Marathon Oil and ExxonMobil have been there for some time. The Chinese have increased their presence in Equatorial Guinea. What role do they play?
Well, I mean, they play a huge role. The economy is entirely dependent upon oil and gas. So I think over 90% of Equatorial Guinea's foreign export earnings are based around the hydrocarbon sector. So essentially, the only productive part of the economy, in the international sense, is the interaction that Equatorial Guinea has with these companies from China or the West, exporting their natural resources.
And Tutu Alicante, Tawanda Kanema, before he was cut off, he was talking about the lobbying efforts by the government of Equatorial Guinea in Washington to effectively put pressure on the U.S. government. We do know that Lanny Davis, Bill Clinton's former legal advisor, has been a registered lobbyist for Equatorial Guinea. I believe the chief of staff to Senator Roy Blunt, the former chief of staff, was a lobbyist for Equatorial Guinea. They've hired a number of big PR firms, including Corvus. How effective have they been at getting their message out?
Well, I think, and related to the question that you have for Tawanda, just on Monday, there was a picture of President Obama, or I guess the presidential family, Obama and Michelle, and Theodorin, the son of President Obiang, who is not the head of state, and who, you read the words from the Department of Justice's press release, you know, when that case settled, right? So how is it that someone whose asset has been seized in the United States, who we know have been embezzling money from that country and laundering through U.S. banks, gets to take a peek, and who is holding, by the way, a non-constitutional position, because there is no such thing in Equatorial Guinea's constitution as the second vice president, right? So this is an unconstitutional person who is only there because he's the son of the president. How is it? How do we justify the picture between Theodorin and the Obamas, right? And clearly, it has to be attributed to the oil companies and to the incredible work that these lobbying companies or these PR firms are doing, thanks to the millions of dollars that, you know, instead of helping citizens in the country, instead of going to address the basic needs in healthcare, in education, are being siphoned out here to lobbying firms who are helping to launder that money by their actions.
Tawanda Kanema, your take on this. How effective has Equatorial Guinea been in getting its message forward through lobbying in Washington, D.C.?
I would say very effective. Lobbying has really, really done a good job of trying to whitewash, you know, the government's image. And it's the reason, you know, we stumbled upon one of Mr. Obiang's image management agencies. You know, they have this basically a pipeline where they bring in photographers into the country to document Mr. Obiang donating to schools and doing these supposedly charitable activities. And this in turn helps to counterbalance the reporting about the human rights situation in the country and the corruption in the country. So I think lobbying firms have done a lot to try and present this regime in positive light.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're looking at Equatorial Guinea and how a tiny country is causing big problems for its people. Joining us this week from Washington, D.C., Tutu Alicante, Executive Director for Equatorial Guinea Justice, a human rights group. From Berkeley, California, Tawanda Kanema, producer of the documentary The Prince of Malabo, Power, Money, and Impunity. And from London, Oscar Scafidi, a business risk consultant and travel writer who is author of the new Brat Guide to Equatorial Guinea. Oscar Scafidi, one challenge for Equatorial Guinea is that oil revenues are declining and its population has been growing very rapidly, almost 3%. A lot of those people live in Malabo and on islands in the Gulf of Guinea. What's the economic outlook for this country?
Well, I suppose that depends who you ask. The official plan is to try and diversify the economy away from oil dependence. And they've got this plan called the Horizon 2020 Development Plan. And I think that the plan is basically to diversify into five different areas, one of them being tourism. I'm not sure how that's going, to be honest. And with the global downturn in oil prices, that's made the situation for the government even more difficult because they don't have that oil revenue to invest in trying to diversify things.
And what about other parts of the economy then? Is there still substantial agriculture in Equatorial Guinea? I know at one time it was a coffee producer, it was a cocoa producer. Did those parts of the economy, have they thrived during the oil period or have they withered?
Well, they've withered. So we talk about Dutch disease, so the effect of oil and its negative impacts on the rest of the economy. So the majority of Equatorial Guinea citizens are engaged in subsistence farming. I mean, there is still some cocoa being produced, but certainly not at sort of export levels and certainly not enough to make a large dent in the export revenues.
Tutu Alicante, President Obiang has been in power now for 36 years. His son seems to be in line to be his successor. Obviously, someone who has been quite controversial, got quite a lot of negative attention around the world. What do you envision a potential transition, political transition, looking like there?
Sadly, Equatorial Guinea has become a case in which it is hard to imagine a peaceful political transition happening there. Right? I think the current government has ensured that there are no institutions that could guarantee that type of peaceful transfer of power. The parliament is a complete joke. There is no judiciary system. Political parties, inside the country, there is only one meaningful political opposition party, which is very, very weak and dependent on the same government that is supposed to be running against. So it's next to impossible to imagine a peaceful transition of power in Equatorial Guinea. In my opinion, the only way you get transfer of power from these kleptocrats that have been holding on to power for the last 36 years is when you have the involvement of the international community, the African Union, members of the CEMAC, the regional government institutions, you know, from Central Africa, involving fostering a democratic transition. Other than that, you know, it's difficult. Either that or the alternative, you know, which for me, you know, is citizens rising up and demanding some changes, as it has happened recently in Burkina Faso and in other places, or in Senegal, to cite a perfectly good example.
Tawanda Kanema, you know, we've heard about many of the problems in Equatorial Guinea. How is it that the country has remained so peaceful, and how is it that the government has been able to maintain control for this long, given the amount of money coming into the country and given sort of the widespread poverty that exists there?
I think that's partially because of, you know, the country's geographic location. They say geography is destiny, and I think for regime longevity, geography can also be destiny. The Equatorial Guinea is quite isolated in terms of, you know, being the only former Spanish colony in the region. So they don't benefit from sort of the media chatter that would normally help sensitize citizens to what's happening inside their country, you know, by virtue of receiving media from your neighboring countries, like we've seen in the region. So Equatorial Guinea is quite isolated politically, and I think it's been a blessing for the capital to be located on an island that's really difficult to access from the mainland. So that could be an element of why the regime has managed to be so successful at maintaining its grip on power. But the other thing is also just the repression, just, you know, the clampdown on free speech, on the press, and on the political opposition. So that tends to, you know, keep dissent down. There's strong monitoring and surveillance of the opposition, of journalists. Just a week before we got into the country, two reporters from the Financial Times were arrested, and, you know, they had all of their equipment seized, and they were detained for 7 hours simply for interviewing people that had not been cleared by the government to have...
And Tawanda Kanema, it looks like we've lost you again. Oscar Scafidi, you heard Tutu Alicante talking about what a potential transition might look like in Equatorial Guinea. What is your sense of as to how that might go, and what role is there for the international community, for other African leaders to play a role in that?
Well, I think the generally accepted view is that Teodorin will take over, although there are some questions around one of Obiang's other sons, Gabriel, perhaps also aiming for the top position, but he's sort of an outside runner, as it were. In terms of the role of the international community, I think, to be honest, it will be quite limited. From the point of view of America and the West, their main interest will be to keep it peaceful as possible, or at least peaceful enough to not interfere with their economic activities in the country, mainly being the export of oil.
And Tutu Alicante, how transparent is this regime? How easy is it to get access to them, to have dialogue with them? Your group is obviously a human rights group, has been very critical. But do we see the president, do we see other government officials giving interviews to journalists when they're outside the country, when they travel to the United Nations, to other African capitals?
So it depends on, you know, the journalists, and it depends on, you know, whether these journalists have been cleared by the PR firms. I mean, to give you an example, there is a video out there of the president naming me as a traitor of the nation, right? And people like myself, you know, do have basically no access. Any human rights activist, any journalist that has ever published anything critical of the regime has no access, right? And we have asked for interviews with the president and members of the cabinet when they are here in Washington, D.C., and, you know, we have zero access. However, if you're trying to invest in the country, or if you're trying to help produce a PR video that then they can showcase with what's going on inside the country, you know, then yes, you can have access.
That'll do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Tutu Alicante, Tawanda Kanema, and Oscar Scafidi for coming on the program. Global Journalist executive producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Javila Raskas-Kate, Elenia Kaya, Juhyun Lee, Zuhang, and Arjun Peng. Our studio director is Travis McMillan from RJI, and our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.